Welcome to the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast, where you'll get actionable tips and advice on major gifts, direct response fundraising, legacy giving, and much more from leading experts in the nonprofit sector. Now, here are your hosts of the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast, Andrew Olson and Roy Jones.
Hey, good afternoon, everyone. This is Andrew Olson with the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Roy Jones. Hey, Roy, good afternoon.
Hey, Andrew. Good to be with you again.
Glad we're all here and really excited. So we've got a real treat today. Our friend Dan Reed, who's CEO of Seed Fundraisers. Hey, Dan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
We're really excited to be with you today, particularly excited to hear you share about training in the nonprofit space. And I think, you know, what our listeners will find is that you've got a unique perspective on the value of training and the impact. So I'm really hopeful that you'll share that with us and we'll get some great insights from that. Before we get into anything too significant, I'd love for you to share a little bit about yourself, your background, and Seed Fundraisers.
Yeah, sure. Well, thanks again for having me. I appreciate it. Yeah. So, you know, I'm a bit more of those rare professional fundraisers who actually started fundraising in college. And so I remember when I was 19 years old, I had 45 days left to complete, 50, 60 hours of volunteer time to go from my sophomore to my junior year of college. And so no one has ever convinced me to do anything on time. And so that's pretty normal for me. And so I went to two organizations and I asked them both the same question. One was a small community development organization on the North Shore of Pittsburgh. And the other one was a national political organization. And I asked them both the same question. They both said, fundraising. Fundraising is the thing we need help on that no one volunteers to do. And so I got my start in fundraising. I was first introduced to fundraising by just volunteering. I had to get all these volunteer hours in. And so I started writing direct mail, political fundraising direct mail. My degree's in history and philosophy. I mean, there was no intent here, right? And so that's how I got started in fundraising. And that was, essentially what happened was about 3 months later, I was still volunteering, but it was starting to work. Like the mail I was writing was raising some money. And so they offered me to basically contract job to continue writing fundraising mail. And when you're 19 years old, it's nice to make money. And so I just kept doing it, very unintentionally. And I kept doing that. And so I kind of followed where the job took me very unintentional, kind of got into fundraising. And so did that for a long time. And after 15 years, I kind of look at my fundraising career in two halves. The first half, for the first 8 years, there was a lack of intentionality in my work. And the second 7 years, there was a high level of intentionality in my work. Mm. I like to say that in my first 8 years, I was a B minus C plus fundraiser. I was okay. And in my second half, I was great. And it's because in my eighth year, I really adopted a conviction for the intrinsic value of this work. And so, yeah. So after then 15 years of fundraising, my heart for the fundraiser kind of expressed itself in Seed Fundraisers, which I launched 4 years ago. And we spend all of our time just training, equipping, and coaching fundraisers across philanthropy.
And the thing that just, it's impressive to me, and just seeing your background, and it reminded me of a conversation I had with Roger Craver about 10 days ago at the AFBICON meeting. You've worked for organizations like National Right to Work and the Morris Animal Foundation. And Roger said, these techniques work, because he knew my background being a Republican fundraiser. Mm-hmm. These techniques work right or left. It's not philosophical. It really is science. And just talk to me about your career track. Is just very interesting to me.
Sure. Yeah. That's a great point. I got started in political fundraising with National Right to Work Committee. I tell you what, in political fundraising, it's a crash course in the science of direct response, right? Yeah. And so that's where I got my start, but they also gave me the chance to do a little bit of major gift work as well towards the end of my 5 years there, with doing contract work there. Mm. And that got me really interested in just those, I started to taste some of the joys of deeper philanthropic conversations. the reason why I left political fundraising was I actually have a deep respect for it. And I value people that can stick with it for a long time. For me, what I found was that in political fundraising, a lot of the core messaging is, if you don't give, something awful is going to happen. Mm. Versus I think a more pure philanthropic message is, when you give, something beautiful and amazing can happen.
I love that.
And I just decided, you know what? I can't give my work to one environment. I can't breathe that air forever. And so I'm going to switch. I'm going to breathe different air. And that's,
I love that.
Hey, Roy, how many appeals have we written and executed that followed the former construct that Dan talked about?
you can generate a lot of transactional gifts.
For sure.
That type of messaging. But if you're looking to do transformational giving, you really have to go the direction Dan mentioned just now. It's genius.
And Dan, you went to Morris after that, I think. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. Did you work with Scott Koskoski there?
I sure did. Yeah. Scott, I served as our chief development officer for almost 8 years at Morris Animal Foundation. And Scott served as our director of major gifts for a number of years there as well. And so, yeah, I got to work with Scott pretty closely.
Gotcha. Yeah, he was on the podcast a few sessions ago. It was a great interview. So
that's great.
Glad to have both of you now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Talk to me about this. So I've been fascinated. I think you and I met a couple months ago in Pittsburgh. And what I was really interested in when you were talking about the training that you conduct, you know, most consultants that provide training in our space are focused on training the fundraiser so that she or he can go be effective for the organization. And I appreciated that you have a completely different perspective about that. I don't think you discount their need to be successful for the organization, but your focus is really on adding value for the fundraiser. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. Yeah. There's a whole lot of opinions I could probably have about the issue. But I remember when I started to consider seed as a concept, you know, about 5-6 years ago now, I started to realize that what I think was primarily missing from our profession was a vision for what it means to be a fundraiser. What is the space or the role that we occupy in our culture that is beyond a cause or beyond a specific organization? And so what I looked around, and really what this came down to is, okay, as fundraisers, we're kind of asked to have a passion. Well, not kind of. We're hired to have a passion for the cause that we work for, right? So that's one thing that is true. The second is that we may be trained. There may be training to execute the work of fundraising. But what I really felt was missing, which is kind of part of my own story, was where is our internal kind of vocational conviction for the intrinsic value of the work? And so the backstory here essentially is that I have loved all three primary places I've worked in my career. I really did. I love them. And all of them had, they saw fundraising for its extrinsic value in that, well, you do fundraising so the real work can happen, right? And I remember my eighth year of fundraising, I remember having a conversation with my grandfather. And my grandfather, and I was talking to him about kind of this, some of my, you know, it's a little bit existential, but it was kind of my angst around work, which all of us go through from time to time. And he asked me, he said, Dan, and my whole family comes from a hardwood furniture makers in Southern Kentucky and East Tennessee. And I remember him asking me, he said, Dan, why do you think carpenters become master carpenters? Why do you think they submit to years of bloody knuckles and failed scrap wood in the back of the shop? He said, they don't do it because they love tables. And it was like, it like clicked, right? I was like, well, why then, Grandpa? Why did they do that? And he said, they do it because they love creating something out of the element of wood. And for me, who is kind of going through this process kind of vocationally for myself and occupationally, I said, man, I want that. Right? I want to have a conviction about the intrinsic value of my work, not just when I raise money, some good cause occurs. And the reality is, as I think from a training perspective, we can train, you know, it used to be that we were missing tactical training in our profession. I just don't see that as the case anymore. Like, I just feel like if anything, we're overloaded on tactical training. I still think what's deeply missing is why are people committing their work to, or why are they committing their time to the work of fundraising? And I just want to speak, and I just think others should speak to this intrinsic value of fundraising. What is our vision for the fundraiser intrinsically? What craft do we have? What craft are we committing ourselves to, and why? And that's, I think, so from a training perspective, I know it's Seed, but I know a number of other consultants and coaches that kind of understand this too. I just think as a profession, we need more training voices, professional development voices, et cetera, that are not so much, or they're as concerned with the heart behind fundraising. And do we hold a conviction about this intrinsic value of our craft? Mm. And do we submit to this as a craft and less as a means to an end? As we do how to write, you know, the science behind appeal writing, which the science behind appeal writing is necessary. But I actually think that part of our 16-month, you know, tenure rates and all the issues, I don't know. I don't get a sense that that's really an issue of we're not training our people to be good enough fundraisers. I think we are, and there's fundraisers that don't care because they don't hold some internal conviction about them. Yeah,
I think there's a lot of truth to that. Roy, what do you think about this idea?
Yeah, I mean, I think too, it's you're right. There are a few bad actors in the industry, but I emphasize few. I really think you're right that technology-wise, we're seeing more and more charities, regardless of their size, regardless of how big or how small they are, you know, adopting the right principles of caring for our supporters and donors, and really viewing that as a sacred duty. My job is not to ask for money for my charity. My job is to really care and be an advocate for the donor, because when you do that, yeah, they will give money. And I love your heart, you know, just the whole concept of caring for those that care for donors. And that's powerful. That's powerful. That speaks to my heart.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I think that one of the ideas, I think that we live in fundraising in general is like a second, third, fourth career for so many people. Right. Mm-hmm. And so over time, over the decades, right, of our profession maturing in certain ways, we kind of, when you enter the profession as a fundraiser, you're kind of entering a culture of unintended career choices in some way. And I think part of the result of decades of that is that the training, the professional training environment becomes somewhat scattered. And we didn't, because of the way everyone becomes a fundraiser, we didn't start with the first things, right? We started with
a science major. I was going to run for Congress. I was going to be president of the United States.
Didn't happen. Right.
Dan, I was a philosophy major. I was always told that I needed to learn how to say, do you want fries with that?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I do think that there's an opportunity for our profession to dive more into the poetry of our work and the heart and the sacredness behind our work. You know, I've worked with there's a couple organizations that I've worked with that have they've taken this craft of fundraising to such heart that at the end of the year, they actually celebrate how much their staff raised for other organizations. When you are able to actually occupy the role and the space of a fundraiser beyond Morris Animal Foundation employee, but when you occupy the space of a fundraiser, you are activating generosity, and you can always control where that happens. And if you just bowed out the moment you knew that wasn't going to go to Morris Animal Foundation, is the moment that in some level you're actually not carrying through the conviction that you hold in your work. And so these couple organizations are just, I value them significantly in how they've institutionalized that concept.
Wow.
So Dan, who do you think primarily owns the responsibility for shepherding this discussion in our industry? I mean, you know, I think of governing bodies like CFRE and AFP, and I'm not sure that I see either organization, not to pick on those two, they're just the two easiest to think of. I'm not sure that I see either of those two as sort of leading voices in that kind of conversation. What's your take on that?
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah, I I don't know the answer here. There's a few players, right? So the first is the individual fundraiser. Because at the very core, we are all responsible for recognizing and pursuing kind of meaning in our work to whatever, and that's a privilege, by the way. That's a total cultural privilege to care about that and have the ability to do that. Yeah, but we do hold that responsibility on individual levels. So I think that there's that. I do think that not one person or one organization can hold the weight. Two, I would say that organizations within our sector, they do hold the responsibility to value and recognize that all work holds intrinsic value and begin to incorporate that in their own culture, right? I had one organization that took that piece, one organization that actually changed their mission statement to include, it was something like, we gather generous people to make ... their mission happen. So they churn their mission statement to include the fact that we are a fundraising organization. We fundamentally believe in doing this via generosity. We would therefore choose, even if someone gave us all the money we needed, we would still fundraise because that's an actual thing that we believe in. So I think organizations hold a responsibility to create an environment and a culture where someone living into their craft matters. I do think that the real point that your question was making is there an entity that holds a banner, right? Or is there someone, right, that's carrying this banner? And I don't know who holds the responsibility. I do know that the consultants and coaches in this space have a real opportunity to set themselves apart and be a bit prophetic and sage in the sense that, you know, we have the ear of some of a lot of people, and maybe we should be taking it upon ourselves to do first things, right? To care about first things. And I would like to see the consulting and coaching world take more responsibility for activating and inspiring the hearts of individuals within the space, more than just, hey, let's talk about your organizational strategy, which is important, absolutely critical, but also kind of curious. Yeah, if we also hold a responsibility to kind of poke and stir the hearts of fundraisers on the ground.
Yeah, I mean, I when I hear you say that, it just reminds me of, and I don't know who said this, but the sort of business mantra of culture eats strategy for lunch, right? And I think, you know, that's right. To your point, strategy is important, but if you don't have the precursors, both individually and organizationally, then no amount of strategic thinking and no amount of tactical expertise is going to be worth anything.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, I do wish that AFP, you know, AFP is an association. So fundamentally, right, they're designed to represent everyone, which is always going to be lowest common denominator. And I don't mean that in a derogatory mean, I just mean that in a very straightforward way, right? They represent everyone. And so they have very, very wide guardrails. They have to, because they represent, you know, a couple hundred thousand professional fundraisers in this space. Their actual membership is what, 30,000, 50,000, something like that. So I understand that. And also, I think there's such a need for that unified voice for the sector at large, a unified voice for the craft of the fundraiser or the role of the fundraiser in our culture. And I don't think that there's an organization that really carries that banner today. I would love to see AFP start to incorporate that more. Again, back to their design. They're designed to tackle all the issues. And so when you're designed to tackle all the issues, it's really difficult to decide, to be prescriptive about what the core issue is, or what the priority issue will be.
Yeah, it really is. I find it very interesting, and I'm a big proponent of AFP, and literally require all my major gift officers to join it, because for exactly that reason, so that they can get a better picture for the broadness of philanthropy. It's not just about asking somebody with capacity for a big gift. That's just the icing on the cake. That's not the cake. But it is interesting that when you look at AFP, I find some of the most widely, always the biggest crowds are those sessions that involve training frontline fundraisers. the people that are meeting face-to-face with those with capacity. And again, I think a lot of it has to do not just with what's being said from the platform, but being in the room with each other. There is just an energy there. I can't explain it. You know, when I'm in the room with 300, 500 frontline fundraisers, primarily major gift officers, I mean, it's empowering, you know, and we share with one another, and it is, it really is an exciting thing. I love what you're talking about with training and caring for these fundraisers. But what do you think, and to steal a title of a number one bestseller on best business books on Amazon, what are the common mistakes we make in training fundraisers today? Sorry, Andrew, I took your steam, brother.
And Dan, if you can come up with 101 of them.
I'm pretty sure you just did 50 and then you wrote the book twice. Yeah.
I get this call, Roy, I need 5,000 more words.
Preferably 22 different mistakes, please.
Well, I've got one I've got two. The first is, I think we really love, and real quick, before I answer that, I really wanted to encourage something you just mentioned, Roy, which was AFP is, you know, for things that cannot be by design. The one thing that it is so good at, and it's so refreshing, is to for fundraisers. There are tens, hundreds of thousands of fundraisers in one person, two person shops. They do not engage other fundraisers on a daily basis. They do not know that other fundraisers exist out there on a daily basis. And what AFP provides is a sense of belonging, in a craft, right? And it's a bit of a guild in that regard. And I really appreciate that about AFP more than anything. Is just the gathering. So I do want to mention that, because I think that's a really important piece of, yeah, professional development and fundraising is actually belonging to a guild. And I think that's important. So to answer your question though, around what might be missing from training, I think there's two things come to mind. The first is training in this, like, professional development in general in fundraising feels like such a choose your own adventure story. To become an accountant, there's no choose your own adventure. You know, to become a Marine, there's no choose your own adventure. Like, there's, you could keep going. To become a master carpenter, there's actually not a choose your own adventure. So there's just like, it's such an overwhelming thing for a fundraiser to say, I want to be a better fundraiser. Where do I go to do that? That very simple question does not have a simple answer. And so that myriad of options, I think is overwhelming to the average fundraiser who, you know, they fell into it. It's a second, third, fourth career, you know, et cetera. And so I do think that's something that's missing which is kind of leads to my second, which is that our training is not prescriptive enough. We're very descriptive. And we like to say that there's different ways to do things, but we're not really willing to be prescriptive about the absolute best way to do something. So there are best practices, but they seem like we hedge against them a little bit, or we're timid, I guess, mm-hmm. in stating this is the way of the fundraiser. And I think that's something that's missing, is especially for those fundraisers earlier in their career. It's like, will someone please just prescribe the path to me? Because I want to be great at this. I might even have this internal conviction that this is good work. But will someone prescribe the path to me about how to do that? Wow. And, you know, we work in fundraising. We work with a lot of different common language is kind of still kind of up in the air for us. And so that's part of that, is like we're missing a prescription. We're missing a common language by and large. And therefore, our training opportunities seem like this choose your own adventure. It seems like 1,000 points of light. Yeah, there's some academic improvement along this. I mean, you're saying some things in higher ed, in our master's programs that are trying to get there. But so far today, I still think that it's very difficult for an average fundraiser to say, I want to become better. What do I do? What path do I walk?
So Dan, I'm curious, we're coming up close on time, but I'd love if you could share with us a couple of ideas for how organizational leadership, so when I say that, I mean chief executives, chief development officers, and especially boards, can better support the professional development of fundraisers in their shops?
That's a great question, yeah. So the first one, kind of going back to a previous conversation, is I think executive directors and boards can listen to the heart behind fundraisers. So by the way, this goes for anyone in an organization, right? For executive leadership to know the heart behind what brings someone to work every day. But I think that is certainly even more beneficial to the fundraiser, to the frontline fundraiser, who, you know, in a cause-based organization with a strong mission and a strong drive towards missional achievement, it's even almost easier for a board member and executive director to not listen to these other crafts and these other hearts going on in the organization. So I think once a year for a board and an executive director to go through the process of listening for why a fundraiser is doing what they're doing would be just an incredible opportunity. And second to that is actually asking a fundraiser to share why they are practicing their craft there at that organization. Does an incredible thing for the culture. I remember at Morris Animal Foundation, I asked the executive team, hey, can I share with the entire staff why I fundraise? Because we were kind of suffering from this program fundraising, you know, divide that always happens in organizations, and this, you know, fundraising a necessary evil piece. And so I shared for maybe 15 minutes why I am a fundraiser, and you'd be shocked. Like people, once you're just able to share that, people realize there's a heart behind this work. This person isn't just some, you know, executing a sales cycle here. There's actually a heart. Yeah, that's right. Like that's not what's going on. There's a heart behind this work. There's a conviction behind this work. And when you get someone, when you get a fundraiser who articulates that to your staff, to your executive committee, to your executive director, to your board, I really think that over time, it starts to change the environment and the culture and the air that fundraisers breathe in an organization. And says, you know what, this is a place that also values that. This is a place that respects the craft of fundraising in addition to our purpose and our reason for being as an organization, which is to solve a problem, tackle a cause. So I think that's probably the thing that comes to mind first and foremost, is just executive leadership listening to the heart behind the work.
I'm impressed that you just didn't say spend more money on training.
Yeah, well, you know, that was spend more money on training. There it is.
Right. We'll say it for you.
Yeah, I think it's interesting too. It we've kind of danced around this issue a bit, but so often I think leaders are quick to remove the chief development officer. I am one, so I can talk bad about him. So often we're quick to try and replace people in the field or on the support staff, when what we really should be doing is equipping them. And I think so often we're again, I don't know where the time cycle was developed inside our industry to where, you know, I mean, the average person in my chair lasts about 18 months. And it is, again, I think the primary reason that happens is because of the lack of training and understanding and really building a, as Andrew touched on, a culture of philanthropy in the organization.
You know, it's interesting. There's a woman by the name of Stacey Gerdner. So Stacey's going to be on the podcast sometime later this year. She's the CEO of a firm called Praxis Group, and they do a lot of leadership development. Roy and I know Stacey because she used to be the chief people officer at Russ Reed, where we both worked. And she is very fond of saying to people in leadership, you know, if you have an employee that has a problem that is not performing at the level that they need, chances are it's not that the employee chooses to just blatantly disregard what your expectations are, or that they might even not know what they are. Chances are it's probably a leadership issue, and look in the mirror first before you look to exit the employee, which is super difficult to absorb as a leader, right? To think, well, wait a minute, I've made it into leadership. Why would this be my fault? But I think so often, you're right, Roy, that the missteps are not that, you know, that you've got somebody in the seat who's wrong for the job. Maybe sometimes they are, but largely I think it's more about the fact that we haven't either equipped our leadership to know how to give good direction, to know how to develop their people, and to provide the kind of training that Dan's talking about to really get at the heart of the work that they're doing to make sure that they're fully equipped to be successful. So I think for as much as we might pick at other things, we as leaders all own the responsibility to look at ourselves first when we start to think that there might be a problem with an employee on our team. Don't you think?
Absolutely. Dan, talk to me, and I know we got to finish up here. We're getting to the end, but Andrew's just going to have to cut and splice something else I said here. This whole concept of activating generosity and changing the culture in the organization itself, what are some ways that you do that as counsel to an organization?
Yeah, I think that a couple things come to mind. The first is sharing this vision for the fundraiser publicly. I think it's helpful for executive leadership, staff at large, to be able to say, if you're a fundraiser here at this organization, this is the role you occupy, and this is a place in which we value it and we respect it. So I think that there's just being public and saying, we have an imagination for this role. We have a vision for this role, and we want our fundraisers to occupy this, have a real conviction for it. So that, you know, kind of to Andrew's point, you know, I do have to look at myself. You know, when I was responsible for a fairly significant fundraising group at Morris Animal Foundation, I didn't share this nearly as much as I should have. I didn't even hire for it like I should have. I was still trying. I was like figuring it out, right? Yeah, there were folks that I hired that did not occupy this space, that does not occupy this more meaningful role of fundraising. And yeah, and so I definitely didn't institutionalize this imagination for fundraising in my hiring practices or in my weekly department meetings or in, you know, all staff meetings or in board meetings where I had the opportunity 3 times a year to share the heart behind the whole fundraising department, right? Didn't do it. But those are ways in which if I look back, I say, you know, I really wish that I could have instilled that more and institutionalized that more in talking about it more. And then of course, I think that we celebrate the big gifts a lot in fundraising, right? We celebrate when we hit revenue goal, we celebrate performance, right? Revenue performance a ton. And I have a little bit of, I've started to question that a bit, where I want to celebrate what happens when we celebrate the truly generous gift that might have been the $50 gift. And in the last year that I was at Morris, I started to put the bottom 5 donors of our organization by gift amount on my portfolio. And there was as much generosity there as there was at the, you know, the $100,000 gift. And so celebrating generosity, not revenue, I think is another way in which we can institutionalize this with our organization.
That's really interesting. I know it from a heart perspective on generosity. It's hard for me in a logical construct to think about what you just said, particularly about putting, you know, quote unquote, bottom 5 donors into a portfolio. Mm-hmm. I love the idea because it really is. And I think we've all seen that sometimes she or he who has less gives more. And it's infinitely more generous often. Just hard to think about when you think about real resource allocation.
totally. Yeah. And like, you know, putting, you know, doing certain stewardship activities, right, in our annual giving program for, you know, the reality is that we actually don't have a metric for generosity. We have a metric for giving.
For sure.
And,
yeah.
You know, and so institutionalizing that becomes very different, or operationalizing it, I should say, becomes very difficult. But saying we care about generosity as a value, I think that's things we can institutionalize, even if it's harder to operationalize it.
Yeah, I think that's great. Yeah. Hey, Dan, we are out of time. Thank you so much for being here today. Really appreciate it. Love the content. If folks want to get in touch with you, if they want to learn more about you, more about Seed Fundraisers, how do they do that?
Sure. They can visit seedfundraisers.com, easiest way. And my email address and phone number are on the website. So super easy. Also welcome to look me up on LinkedIn, another reliable way to get a hold of me.
Perfect. Well, thanks a lot, Dan. Really appreciate it today.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for the time. I appreciate it. Take care.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast, brought to you exclusively by Newport One. Newport One can make a difference in your fundraising so that you can change the world. You can always reach us at podcast@newportone.com. Please take a moment to rate this episode on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. When you rate this episode, it will help more nonprofit leaders just like you to help find us and get the information that they need to raise more funds for their organization. Thanks again for listening today.